No, Ken, I think two of the things I would like to talk about today that I think would be very informative would be, I want to talk about hypochondriasis, and I want to talk about panic attacks. All right. Now, the reason I say both of those is because I've just recently spent some time with Neil Schachter, who is a pulmonologist who is talking about the psychological component of a lot of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And he was saying that a lot of the agitation and aggravation of a condition very often is based on the psychological factors. And one of the things that he addressed was panic attacks. Would you teach us a little about panic attacks?
Sure. One of the things about panic attacks is that they often come out of nowhere, and it's often an overwhelming feeling of either fear or shortness of breath or feeling like you're going to have a heart attack or something's wrong with your stomach. So it's usually a whole slew of physical symptoms that occur. And once they occur, then the mind can go into either a very negative, catastrophic state, or hopefully we'll talk today about ways to not have that chain reaction take place, and you can recognize the attack for what it is and be able to calm yourself down.
Is a panic attack always caused by some kind of negative thinking?
No, I mean, as you're implying, sometimes even physical realities of maybe a skip beat of your heart or something wrong with your swallowing or your stomach or having some real asthma or pulmonary disease may set up a nidus. Now, for other people, it seems like it truly comes out of the blue, that the initial attack really is produced in the brain in a way that we don't quite understand as a result of stress or the like. But whether it's caused by physical or caused by psychological or biological, once the process starts, that's where it's important to be able to intervene.
Where I grew up, somebody got sick. The minute they got sick, someone would say, you got to go to a doctor. And most people would say, nah, leave it alone. Let's see what happens to it. The normal response to the initial phase of an illness is leave it alone. Leave it alone. Let's see what happens to it. We've observed it. We've watched it. Let's leave it alone. And most people kind of make room for the fact that they could have like visiting entities just coming through, a bug or something like that, coming through, and they're not going to respond so strongly. Other people panic at the very thought of being ill. What makes one person panic and the other person say, leave it?
Well, it depends if you're talking to the biological psychiatrist out there or whether you're talking to the cognitive behavioral psychologist. I would think that it's a complicated answer. Certainly some people would say that if you're genetically or prone towards anxiety because of the serotonin or dopamine or noradrenergic system in your brain, if your parents have that genetic predisposition, that could be a reason why you're more likely to become more anxious. Other psychological and psychoanalytic thinking would be that if you're somebody that had a great deal of trauma growing up and had emotional abuse, verbal abuse, neglect and the like, that may have set you up for a lifelong of a sort of post-traumatic stress disorder where you may react to situations and go in your head to a very catastrophic, anxious place, which is perhaps a very adaptive way of dealing with trauma when you're small, weak, and helpless, not such an adaptive thing to do as an adult, particularly when the symptoms you're having are really not that problematic. They're just, a little skip heartbeat or a little bit of difficulty swallowing or just a little bit of butterflies in your stomach that means nothing.
My guest is Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. Some people have, when they have any kind of a symptom at all, an itch on their finger, they panic, and then they panic privately. They stay away from people. This is where, that's where the hypochondriasis comes in. They worry about it, and they worry about it, and they keep worrying about it. I knew a young man who went to a doctor practically every other day. And now, there's a new range of doctors called concierge doctors. And a concierge doctor is, if you got enough money, there's a physician who says, I'll come to you. And if you've got enough money, you can have them coming all the time. They could be there every day. And I know people who do that. So the new concierge doctors are leading the hypochondriacs to really develop more of the hypochondriasis. And now the concierge doctor is not going to be valued if he keeps coming and saying it's all in your mind. So what the victim will select for, what the person will select for, is they will select for doctors who say, well, here's a nice way to make $500. I'll go visit somebody who's got a cold and let him worry about whether or not he's got cancer. Not that he's going to really encourage him, but maybe not discourage him because of the amount of dollars that are involved. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, I think that there's a whole industry, a whole medical profession out there that has taken vague symptoms and given names to them. There are probably a lot of listeners right now that have very unusual physical complaints of pain, of discomfort. They've gone to doctors. All the tests come back negative. All the objective realities of the examination, the temperature, the blood work, the x-rays, everything is normal. And then they're told, though, you have chronic fatigue, you have fibromyalgia, you have irritable bowel disease. And when you're given that diagnosis, you're assuming the medical profession is saying, oh, yes, that's a well-recognized medical disorder. We psychiatrists and certainly psychoanalytic, psychodynamic therapists think a lot of those people really have a psychosomatic pain syndrome or disorder that's really being manifest, and the medical doctors obviously are incentivized to have them keep coming back, to tell them this is what you have, and perhaps even start prescribing medication that the Hippocratic Oath would say is not such a good idea if the medications isn't really addressing what's going on, if it's psychological in origin, as well as perhaps causing its own problems in the above all do no harm. Well, some of the medications that people get for chronic fibromyalgia, fatigue, narcotics, pain medication is where my work as an addiction doctor comes into play, because some people get hooked on things like that and they have a hard time coming off, or some of the other medications perhaps cause problems in and of themselves.
Of the medical profession itself, though, you know, just the advent of plastic surgery, the whole idea of correcting yourself, doing implants and getting rid of every wrinkle, it is kind of saying, if anything goes wrong, we will fix it medically. And I think plastic surgeons think of themselves as physicians. But I don't think of them as physicians. I think of them as, I guess, carpenters. You know, what they're doing is they're correcting and they're changing, but they're not really looking at the whole person. They're looking at the symptoms. So the advent of plastic surgery has kind of led us to believe that we may be sicker than we think. And now, of course, since science has established such good tests, you know, like MRIs and things like that, and DNA testing, everybody's rushing off because they want to find out what it is that's going to kill them before it's too late. What do you think? I mean, you think that's a good idea? Maybe we should go find out what's wrong with us. We should get full every week. We should get new blood tests. Not a bad idea.
Well, I think that a lot of this underlying anxiety about medical problems and hypochondriasis relates a little bit to a very hard subject for people to wrap their mind around, which is our own issues of mortality and our own conscious or unconscious anxieties about illness and death and what that brings up in people. And yes, I would think most of us really don't want to know when and how we're going to die, let's say. We don't really want to know.
There's a Dr. Falkenhayster who wrote a book in Germany, and in his book he was talking about the part of the reason that people have this hypochondriacal worry is because they are really attracted to death. And what they're really fighting, like Freud said this as well, is thanatos, their own attraction to death. So what they want to find out is they want to find out something's wrong. Every time you go for a mammogram and you walk away and, well, all right, I feel really relieved, nothing there, a pap smear. I feel really relieved, nothing there. Every time people get cleaned out and checked, every time people go in for any kind of a test that's, you know, really invasive, but okay, they seem to be relieved. But I think people want to find out something's wrong. I think people who are really compulsive about getting their bodies checked are looking for the problem. Well, what does the problem do for you? What if you are sick? Maybe, here's an idea, Kent, for you to shoot around. Because there are very few people I could talk to about this. Kent Roberts, you are being a psychotherapist as well as a psychiatrist who believes in the minimal use of medication. Minimal. So, Kent, I think what some people do is they're looking to be special. They're looking to be taken care of. They're looking to have something wrong with them. And it's almost like they want to be children. And they want to have daddy or mommy take care of them. Do you ever find that in your own practice?
Yeah, when we're talking about what is the reasons, all the people listening right now, they're thinking to themselves, why would we produce pain syndromes? What kind of madness is going on? Why would we do that? And the answer is that a lot of these people are, at one level, having some psychological and emotional pain going on in their life that they're not connected with. Now, obviously, Armand talks a lot about alexithymia and people being cut off from their emotions, and they deal with that at the DeMille Center every day, about people's inability to connect with their psychological, emotional world, about the shame, the guilt, the anger, the frustration that they feel. They're not connected with it, and yet the brain, because it feels emotional pain, manufactures physical pain as a way to communicate to people, I'm hurting. For many people, that's the only way they can have that communication to another person. And with that becomes caretaking, nurturing, and the like. And I think a lot of people also need to think that some of you had parents who were perhaps not very emotionally available, very involved, and whether a parent, for example, showed that extra tenderness and extra lovingness when you had a fever and you had a tummy ache and you couldn't go to school. And there was something about being sick that was positive. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to go to school, and people were being very nice to me in a way that I don't think generally people do.
So there is a plus side of it. Isn't there a syndrome where people bring their children in to be sick, and they bring their children to the hospital and they claim their children are sick?
Sure. Yeah, it's called Munchausen's by proxy. Again, Munchausen's and factitious disorder is not psychosomatic, where we're saying that people aren't consciously doing it. But there are other syndromes where...
Munchausen named after the great Munchausen, you know, right, who was a fabricator. He was a guy who made up things all the time, right, and went around the world, very famous. So Munchausen syndrome is when a person makes up things?
That's right. Certainly makes up things as it relates to something physically wrong. They'll put their thermometer under the hot water faucet and say, hey, I got a temperature of 102. So it's not, again, psychosomatic, where they're not doing any behaviors to consciously exaggerate or cause pain syndromes. People with Munchausen's will actually hit themselves on the arm and go into a doctor and say, I'm bruising for no reason, or, as I said, you know, purposely put their thermometer under a hot water faucet and say, listen, I have a fever, I don't know why, and they're consciously doing that. Now, in that...
Have you run into that?
Oh, absolutely, but I think the...
Where do you run into that? Because you're a psychiatrist, you don't have much chance just for physical exams and stuff like that.
Well, certainly seeing people, and now this gets to the area where people get a big positive in our society for being in medically ill, which is disability, which is physical disability, being out on disability, whether you have a car accident or something work-related and the like. And again, are these people making things up in their, or are they amplifying the pain syndrome that they're in? Because you get to stay home, watch Dr. Phil, SpongeBob, and whatever, and you get paid, you know. So there's a pretty nice perk. The
Medicaid, disability, all of these things, and they need you to believe it so that you could file a report on it.
That's correct.
So that they could stay out and keep doing their stuff. Right? So that's one. That's one reinforcement we have for people to do that. What other cases have you run into? You know, you and I have shared many experiences of people who have come to me mm-hmm. for a consultation, and I say, well, I'm not sure, go to Kent. And you've looked at quite a few people where you've come back to me and you said, there's nothing going on here. I think this person's going to get better, but I think it may be a factitious disorder. What is a factitious disorder?
Well, factitious, again, being that there's some conscious decision to amplify or play around with some of the the physical symptoms that they're having, that they're in fact not just having, syndromes and pain syndromes or disorders, they're actually consciously exaggerating it or acting in a way to make their physical symptoms be worse. Obviously, again, everybody who knows about a 10-year-old who has an exam, who in the morning has a tummy ache and the like, and by 12 o'clock is well enough to go out and play ball, knows a little bit about that sort of consciously exaggerating a symptom to, again, get mom to be concerned, to get out of going to school, and then obviously, once you've gotten out of it, you can feel better right away.
How would a parent treat a child who is making physical complaints when you know you're kind of, this is kind of a condition? Because, you know, if you're a mother and your child is making up a stomach ache, and you know they're making up a stomach ache because they have a physics test to take, how does a mother know when it's time to say, forget it, or you will treat it serious? How does a mom know?
I think it's a hard call. I think the intuition about the what's going obviously there are objective findings like having a temperature or actually noticing that there's something wrong going on with a child's bowels and the like. So I would think that the importance of, you know, particularly having a fever and the like is a very important, I think, plus minus, not the only criteria, but a fairly good one to start thinking about of, does this person have a fever or not? If they have a fever, then that's objective reality that something's going on. If they don't have a fever, I would have a question mark starting right up into what's going on.
I want to go back to hypochondriasis and go a little further with that.
Sure.
I mean, hypochondriasis is a excessive fear and worry that something's wrong with your body, and which is slightly different than psychosomatic, which is the feeling that something's wrong with your body. Now, it doesn't have to be either or. There are some people who have both psychosomatic symptoms that trouble them, and they're hypochondriacal. They have worries about what this symptom may be. Is it going to get worse? Is it going to kill me? So just to split hairs a little bit, there's hypochondriasis, which is really a worry that something's wrong medically. And then a lot of what we're talking about today is really the whole great amount of psychosomatic illnesses out there of people who are going to doctors, repeatedly spending money on medication that may be making them worse. And in fact, the pain syndrome, the discomfort that they're experiencing is really psychological in origin, or only small physical amount, but is amplified by the brain for reasons that they're not conscious of in terms of expressing difficult emotions, as well as the perks you get by being sick in our society.
And, true. Let's talk about the type of panic disorders that there are. How many types are there? I mean, the amygdala goes off in the middle of the night. You wake in the middle of the night. You have night terrors. Is that a form of panic attack?
Well, generally, night terrors is related to a bad dream or a nightmare, let's say. So there's a distinction between nightmares, panic attacks, and night terrors. It's thought, again, that in the middle of the night, if it's related to bad dreams that you're having, they would call that, again, a nightmare or a night terror. There are some people with panic attacks who wake up out of sleep without a dream waking them up with the symptoms of a panic attack that we talked about before, which can be a whole slew of feelings like I have a heart attack, something's wrong, my chest is hurting, I can't breathe, something's wrong with my stomach, I can't swallow, I've heard a whole great many, I have to urinate, all sorts of physical, very discomforting physical symptoms that are overwhelming.
What's the best thing to do? Learn about panic attacks. Say to yourself, I'm having a panic attack, and try not to react. Understand, it's a physical condition.
Absolutely. I always use the analogy of being on a plane. When you're on a plane and you've been with pilots and stewardesses and stewards who've been around a bit, whenever there's some turbulence that they run into, you see they're very bland about it and blasé, because in their head, when there's a little bit of turbulence and they've been on flight after flight, they think to themselves, oh, this is a little turbulence, no big deal. A lot of people on the plane, including people who don't fly much, like Kent Robertshaw, start flipping out. Because in my, you know, head, since I don't know much about flying, whenever there's turbulence, I go to, oh my God, the plane's crashing, there's something wrong with the propeller and the like, and et cetera. So that metaphor about what happens on a flight when you hit turbulence is the same metaphor that I want people to think about when they have panic attacks. If when they're having a symptom, their mind says, oh, this is just this stupid panic attack of mine. There's nothing wrong with my heart. There's nothing wrong with my lungs. There's nothing wrong with my stomach. I'm not going to pass out. I'm not having a seizure. That immediately calms you down. If you go in the other direction of, oh my God, am I going to about to pass out? And oh my God, how embarrassing it is it going to be in this subway or in this studio right now having a panic attack, and how shameful and embarrassed I'll be. Then it's going to start amplifying your nervous system, more adrenaline, more norepinephrine, and that's going to make the symptoms worse. So then there's this horrible feedback loop of whatever the initial reason why you're having heart or stomach or lung problems being now amplified with the thought process of, oh my God, what is this? Is this going to be worse? Et cetera, et cetera. That's also one of the reasons why people with panic disorder start avoiding public places. The most people who have agoraphobia, and if you know people that have a hard time being in planes, or people who have a hard time being on in Grand Central or subway or bridge or tunnels, what's fueling their fear of being in big open places is their fear of, what if I have a panic attack in, you know, Duane Reade, or what if I have a panic attack on a subway? So they start making their life smaller and smaller because they don't want to be in a place where they could have this scary, shameful, potentially dangerous panic attack. So most agoraphobia is secondary to panic attacks.
So do you think that the shame and the potential shame is such a big item there? You're saying, you know, I'm going to be embarrassed. It sounds like a school phobia. It sounds like social phobia.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the fear of the panic attack that's going on in people's mind is not only what is going on medically, but again, the shame and embarrassment of being surrounded by people, and how are they going to think of me, and what are they going to think of me if I start flipping out, if I have to sit down and put my head between my legs and start breathing heavily, or how embarrassing it will be for everyone to know I'm nuts and I have panic attacks. So again, that starts limiting people's lives because of the fear that a panic attack will occur in a situation where there's no chance to get help and no chance to just calm down quietly.
Dr. Kent Robertshaw, we're talking to about panic attacks, but Kent, you pass out, you pass out. You pee in your pants, you pee in your pants. You do these things, it's the worst that happens. You know what I mean? I mean, how bad could it be? And you're saying for some people, their fear of embarrassment really dominates their mind. So they have to live in seclusion. They have to stay away from everything because they're afraid. They're afraid they're gonna do things that will totally embarrass them. Well, gee, if somebody passed out in the streets, do you think people are going to look at them and say, oh, look how bad that person is? They're going to take care of you.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, even if you go to the worst-case scenario, I think the third...
Well, I don't know about diarrhea. I don't know. But the worst-case scenario is, I don't know if people are going to come over and take care of you.
But I think that the panic attack itself is problematic. The agoraphobia and the limiting your lives and not doing things where there's this fear of panic attack. But for many of you out there who have anxiety all the time, perhaps your anxiety has been fueled and started by the panic attack. Because what we also know is that once you've had a couple of panic attacks, every day, whether you're conscious of it or not, part of what you're anxious about is the next panic attack that you wake up every day. I remember in September 11th, with the first that attack and then the planes going down and anthrax, I must admit that there were three episodes that caused, you know, Dr. Robertshaw to wake up every day with this low-level anxiety about, what's going to happen today? And that's normally not how I live my life. For people with panic attacks, I think that sense that something bad's going to happen today interferes with their ability to be in the moment and be joyful and happy. So this anxiety about the next panic attack causes a great deal of destruction and unhappiness in people's lives.
I was sure I had it all in perspective, and then the other day we heard an explosion. And I said, oops, and then somebody called and said a building was just collapsed. And it was that building on East 62nd Street, which is five blocks away from here, which kind of imploded from the physician who was killing himself or something like that, or trying to kill himself. And I remember saying to myself, the only thing I have to determine is if it's an attack or if it's something else. Because my mind, although I thought I was perfectly comfortable, I'm fine, I'm not going to worry about things I'm not going to worry about, I felt that thing happen. And it happens to all of us, this little panic. There are little doors that have it. You know, people's little fears, like if you were a kid and you're afraid of mice, well, you may live in, you know, a place where there are mice no more. Like, because you live in tall apartments or something, and then a mouse appears, and boom, you have that panic feeling. Cockroaches, mice, little things from childhood could bring back panicky feelings. Last night, did you remember the thunder last night? Were you around to hear?
Sure.
Wasn't that a thunder of thunders?
Oh, yeah. It sounded like a drum or something.
I watched a cat go crazy. Mm. The cat went insane. The cat called his therapist, right? And he said, I'm getting a little scared by this noise. It's a little too big. Now, I'm saying to myself, it's only thunder and lightning. But it was tremendous thunder and lightning. And I remember that I compared myself to the cat and said, well, I'm not like the cat. The cat's afraid of what they're afraid of. I'm not afraid. I wonder if the cat wasn't there, if I would have gotten frightened. Sometimes people are related to people who are scaredy cats. You know, sometimes you find a mate who gets frightened by things so that you could rise above it and say, there is no worry. Let's talk about nightmares and insomnia. Insomnia specifically. I spoke to another two people today, Kent, who said that insomnia is the bane of his existence. He said he can't sleep. He tries to sleep. He goes to bed. He takes medications. If he takes Ambien, he winds up eating the refrigerator, so he doesn't take that. And he takes Benadryl, but it doesn't help him very much. And it's the insomnia. After a while, if you sleep 4 hours a day, and you just continue 4 hours a day, it wears down on you. What do you think psychiatrically is going on, psychologically?
Well, starting psychologically, I think one of the first things that happens is when people have difficulty sleeping, as you can imagine, the idea that they're starting to go to bed and the worry about the fact that I'm not going to be able to fall asleep tragically causes the insomnia to be worse. So one of the big treatments of insomnia is to de-link in people's heads that thought of, oh, bedtime is now a horrible, uncomfortable, anxious-producing period of my life where I'm going to be awake. Now, obviously, if you're going to bed with all these fears and trepidations about not being able to sleep, it's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So part of the, you know, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. I mean, the beginning part of cracking insomnia is to de-link in people's minds their worries about falling asleep, which will keep them awake. Now, what started the insomnia to begin with is unclear. I think a lot of people are very conscious of the fact that when they go to bed at night, all sorts of yesterdays and the day before, mistakes that I made, I should have called Armand back, I should have told Stephanie she looked good today, all these faux pas, all these human mistakes, because I'm a perfectionist and never want to make a mistake, that comes crowding back and I beat myself up on it. And then tomorrow's worries are now starting to cloud my head. I wonder how Armand's show is going to be received tomorrow, and I wonder, you know, how the stock market will do. So nighttime could be a place where they go into yesterday's mistakes and tomorrow's worries, a surefire way to keep yourself up and miserable.
So do you think, I think that people, when they have insomnia, have a few things going on. I had insomnia for the longest time. And then a friend of mine said, hey, 4 o'clock, let's go for coffee. And I went for coffee, and I was drinking a big Starbucks thing. And they said, oh, you know, I couldn't have that. I'd stay awake all night. So I cut it out, and it was all changed. It made a big difference. So for a lot of people, it could be chemical, right? But But the second thing that happens to people is I think people who deny that the reality and the emotions that happen all day long, the ones who don't pay attention to what they're feeling and how they're interacting with people, and have the people who run over people and ignore people, I think those people have the most nightmares because they haven't faced it. And like you're saying, there's this reservoir of stuff. There's this stuff sitting in there that hasn't been felt, hasn't been experienced. And you dream about it, and it's like eventually the mind says, I don't want you to go to sleep. You go to sleep, you're going to start thinking about this stuff. We have 10 pounds of worry in there. Don't sleep. We have 12 pounds of grief. Don't sleep. Insomnia is very common with people who lose someone they love. There's a very high incidence of insomnia around people who lose their mates. So what they do is they fear going to sleep because they're going to feel the grief that they've tried to deny. So the best solution for insomnia, I think, is what you're saying, Kent. Number one, don't worry about it. You sleep as much as you can and take off the pressure of having to get to sleep. And number two, find a therapist if it persists, because the lack of sleep is very costly. What can the lack of sleep do to you?
Oh, my God. If anybody who has had the experience of being woken up or stayed up, obviously in medical school, you know, having to be on call, lack of sleep in and of itself makes people tired, grumpy, irritable, anxious, and down. So just not having enough sleep in and of itself can cause a lot of symptoms. Now, psychiatrically, sometimes insomnia can be a part of a cluster of symptoms that can go along with both the diagnosis of major depression. It can go along with the diagnosis of mixed bipolar disorder. It can go along with the diagnosis of certain anxiety disorders. So it can be a part of a symptom cluster that goes along with psychiatric disorders that sometimes require medication. But again, as we said before, I always advocate to try to psychologically and more naturally address what may be hurting you or preoccupying your head as you're going to sleep. And as Armand is saying, maybe there are things below the surface. As Freud said, the dreams are telling us what's going on. What are the fears and anxieties and bitter feelings and angry feelings that we're not really wanting to address in, but you can't hide the mind. You can't fool the mind. The mind will come out at night with what's troubling it.
You know, a number of times we will see when somebody comes to see us, and by this I mean, you know, consultation during a therapy session, I'll hear people say, you know, I've never told this to anyone else before. Now, what could that be like? Imagine having something, you're at age 40, and you've never told anyone about something that bothers you. It's a secret. I've never told anyone that when I was a kid, I touched a boy. I've never told anyone that when I was little, I stole something from my mother. I've never told anyone, and we'll very often see, just by the uncovering of the thing, the symptoms disappear around it. It's such a tiny thing. It must make you, as a psychiatrist, wonder where you're going to get your business.
Right. It's, you know, because I think when you're with a therapist and you say something like that, you look at the therapist and you look at their eyes, whether it's Armand, Stephanie, myself, and you see that there isn't all this shame and judgment going on with this horrible quote-unquote secret that you yourself, your own conscience, your own superego, your own Jimmy the Cricket, you've been beating yourself up over the fact that, as Armand said, you touched a boy when you're 11, so that means I'm gay, I'm a faggot. I've been going through my life with those shaming, hateful words in my head. And so when I tell people what happened, they're not reacting that way. That helps me not be so shamed and self-hating and guilty about, again, the humanness of whatever is locked up in my head.
This is Armand DeMille with you with A Positive Mind. Here's a guessing game for you, just for something different to do. I would like you to guess who is singing the next song. This is a guess. All right. Now you're going to have to, I'm going to put this on. This is the next one for you. It's worth the 3 minutes attention, my friends. Who do you think this is? It is somebody you definitely know. It is nobody far out. It is somebody you definitely know.
sì e tenero l'amor con me, ma da quando conosci tu te, so che non ho nulla da desiderare ancora, perché per me tu sei la sola donna al mondo, sì, con te ho scoperto che l'amor può a chi non crede dare un cuor. Ma se tu davvero mami la mia vita insieme a te, più tenera sarà.
Yes, my friends, if you've guessed it, you deserve a prize. And that person is Nat King Cole. Yep. Nat King Cole singing in Italian. Not only did he sing in Italian, he sung in French, and he sang in Japanese.
Sì, è tenero l'amor con me, ma da quando conosci tu te, so che non ho nulla da desiderare ancora, perché per me tu sei la sola donna al mondo, sì, con te ho scoperto che l'amore può a chi non crede dare un cuore. Ma se tu davvero mami la mia vita insieme a te, più tenera sarà. Mai finirà il nostro amore, mai finirà il nostro amore.
Such a sense of timing. Nat King Cole. If you could guess this, Kent. You got the Nat Cole, but if you guess this one.
I did get the Nat Cole.
When you're
Armand DeMille here with Kent Robert Shaw and the rest of the crew, bringing you ideas, concepts, guests to help you lead a more positively minded life, usually on from 1 to 2 o'clock. Here with you from 1 to 3 o'clock today, let's talk about hypochondria a little more. Hypochondria. You know, the term hypochondria comes from the Greek hypo, which means less, below, and chondros, which means cartilage of the breastbone. Did you know that? Now, the term was originally used to describe unidentifiable stomach pains. It was thought by ancient Greek physicians that such pains were caused by the movement of the spleen, an organ located near the hypochondrium, which is the upper right or region of the abdomen. During the 19th century, the term hypochondria became the male counterpart to hysteria. So hysteria was thought of, and a lot of symptoms were hysterical, and then came this hypochondria. So hypochondria can cause one or more of the following effects: anxiety attacks, panic attacks, depression, fear of pending doom, loss of appetite, decreased libido, increased self-consciousness, decreased motivation, and lack of appreciation of Dave Brubeck. All of these symptoms can just appear and grab you. And because it is something that's in your mind, you know, you say in your mind, I'm sick, I'm going to die, there's something wrong with me, it actually makes you weaker. It actually decreases your health because you're worried. Now, Kent, there are worries and there are worries. Kent Robert Shaw, psychiatrist in the studio with me. There are people who worry about things like finances and stuff like that. And then there are people who worry about everything. If you worry about what happened in the past, I guess that's not hypochondriasis. What you're worried about with hypochondria is that you're worried about something in the present, right?
Right.
Okay, and something in the future.
Right. Both related to your body. Worried something's wrong with your body as we speak, and worried about what does it mean? What's wrong with me? Is it going to get worse? Is it going to kill me? So, yes, it's a current feeling that there's something worrisome about my body. Something's not right. And with that, linked with, oh, my God, is this serious?
What do you do? What do you do when you see somebody? I mean, how could there be a hypochondriasis psychiatrically? Is it possible? I mean, by nature of the fact that you are worried about it, it means you are truly disturbed. You know what I mean? You could have hypochondriasis if you've worried about your arm falling off. But how could it be you worry about your losing your mind? Oh, you can, right? You can. We see that often enough.
Sure.
People are afraid they are losing their mind. And usually that happens when they start to feel angry. Usually that happens when people have not been used to feeling angry, and they start to feel angry, they believe that there's something really wrong with them. And they go running to places where, you know, if you investigate it, or when I investigate it, I find out, they've uncovered some anger. Because a lot of people have a lot of anger and resentment from the past, but they don't recognize it and they don't want to deal with it. You know, I mean, so what? You love your father now. Maybe when you were a kid, you didn't like him so much. It's no big deal to recognize it and go through that. Well, for a lot of people, they don't want to do that. They're just ignoring it, so they stay away from it. So what they do is they replace a symptom with their anger, with their fear of anger. So in many cases, hypochondriacal symptoms are people being angry and recognizing anger for the first time.
Absolutely. I think that one of the reasons that's going on in the unconscious mind that's causing the pain in the unconscious mind that's manifested itself in some kind of physical pain is rage, emotional pain, sadness. All those things coming from a very primitive part of the brain that you don't want to look at, you don't want to think about. is going on in your world. And yes, anger is one of the hardest emotions to get validated as an adult or growing up. It's an emotion that's often shamed. It's one of the seven deadly sins as something that's bad. And so connecting with the humanness of being angry and angrier at things in the past is often very freeing for people.
It's a tough thing for people to think, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. It's just perfectly all right to have these feelings. It's a tough thing. 212-209-2950 is our number here, my friends. We are asking you to make a donation to WBAI at the time that we're raising money here. Kent Robert Shaw, of course, is with us, helping us understand and explain a few things. Hypochondria. It's cute because I'm getting tired. And other things like that. Life and breath. Well, you know, if you knowing about your lungs is kind of amazing, my friends. Knowing the chemistry of your lungs and the stuff about your lungs. This book by Neil Schachter, which is available to you for $100. I just can't tell you, if you're anybody who really has been interested in medicine and your own body, it's time to learn. What is COPD? COPD is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And it includes a number of things. People have it. They don't know what it is. It relates to things. You know, a lot of people who smoke cigarettes have it. And a lot of people who smoke cigarettes don't have it. COPD, I mean, how could you get COPD, meaning this chronic obstructive? Did you grow up in a household where one or more of your parents smoked cigarettes? Easy. Right? Do you now smoke at least 10 cigarettes a day? Do you have any allergies? Does anyone in your close family have asthma? You know, most of us grew up, I remember in an office once, I had an office, and I was trying to soundproof the office, and this group of people came in, and they sprayed the entire office and the ceiling, and inside all the doors with asbestos, and they said, "This will soundproof your room." And for years, I lived with this asbestos sprayed everywhere, and so did all the other therapists that were with me. So luckily, I got away with it somehow, found out about it, I sealed it, and I moved my offices. But many people, restaurants, if you look in many restaurants and you look at the ceiling, old restaurants, you see this asbestos sprayed up on the ceiling. Where does it go? Falls into your food, and you eat it. Asbestos is one of the most toxic things of all things. Neil Schachter told a very interesting story. He said Kent cigarettes, you remember Kent with the Micronite filter? The Kent cigarettes with the Micronite filter that was so popular, they made their filter out of asbestos. Yeah. So smoking, which was that nice thing to do if you were sitting on a horse somewhere in the Midwest. Nice thing to do if you were in the army and you were hanging out with your buddies. That's caused quite a bit of damage. And we're learning about it. And whether or not it's smoking or not smoking, you need to learn about it. Life and Breath, Preventing, Treating, and Reversing COPD with Neil Schachter. For a $100 donation to the station, you will learn more about your lungs than most people ever know. And included in that is a book that is about colds and flus. And let me tell you, it's about this time. You must wonder, you must know, that when you get a cold or a flu, you get a little scared sometimes. Is this going to be serious? People who have COPD, who have compromised lungs, a cold is dangerous. Flu is dangerous. You have to watch it closely. This book, The Good Doctor's Guide to Colds and Flu, is available also included in this one premium offer for $100. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. We're trying to bring you more and more stuff about the human mind. Kent Robert Shaw has been working with us for a while. For a $250 donation, we offer you a consultation. A consultation, what does that mean? Consultation means, you know, you want to go and sit and talk to somebody about your mind. You're not sure about your mind. We don't have anything to sell you. Kent doesn't care if you, you know, he'll tell you what he thinks is going on. Maybe you've got depression. Maybe you've got bipolar depression, which is a whole different thing. And it's hard to get people who could recognize it. Or maybe you don't have anything. Maybe you don't have it. Maybe you shouldn't even worry about it. You know, maybe you've got a number of different things going on. Kent Robert Shaw will look at it with you and help you figure it out.
Now, Armand, when we're talking about these psychosomatic disorders that we're saying is due to shame and guilt and anger that's not being addressed in people's lives, I'm not sure if people understand the wide range of things. And again, for many of the people home listening to this under 50 years old, under 55, many of the reasons why they're going to the doctor is thought to be, for many people, either primarily or amplified by psychosomatic reasons. So we're talking about migraines, we're talking about headaches, we're talking about dizziness that of an origin they don't understand. They're talking about uncomfortable feelings with eye pressure and the like, difficulty swallowing, problems with digestive system, irritable bowel syndrome. Again, irritable bowel syndrome is really a wastebasket when they work up your GI problems, you know, stomach ache, constipation, diarrhea, upset, and they can't find anything. They then call it irritable bowel disorder and say that that's the diagnosis. But what, as a psychiatrist and MD, I know that means they haven't found what it is, and they're just telling you this syndrome when, in fact, they don't know what it is. And many psychiatrists like myself would say it's really a psychosomatic equivalent of something going on. But obviously, all sorts of back problems, neck problems, carpal tunnel syndromes. Again, a lot of people with all these kind of chronic pains in their joints and backs, they go to the doctors. Again, many people have very, you know, nothing's really wrong with their x-rays and CAT scans. There's no real correlation between many people's what's wrong with their x-ray and what their complaints are. So again, the whole world of back pain, neck pain, arm pain, all these things people are saying they're experiencing from sitting at a computer all day, maybe it's psychosomatic, their pain syndrome. Obviously, a lot of female complaints about having urogenital pains in their stomach, dysmenorrhea, problems with vaginal pain and the like, certain kinds of impotence and problems, sexual problems. A lot of these problems, I believe, are psychosomatic in origin. Many doctors will, again, give you a diagnosis, maybe give you medication, and not even be curious about how the mind may be amplifying and causing a great deal of these problems.
And many, that sounds like being hypocritical, or should I say hypocritical?
More like hypocritical, I would say.
Well, but because, let's talk about hypocritical.
Yeah, Hippocrates, everyone knows about his famous, above all, do no harm. Hippocrates had the idea 2,000 years ago, through, and it's been true, that most of what a lot of doctors do is interfere with the natural healing process. You know, 2,000 years ago, and even I looked at a journal 100 years ago and all the snake oils and things that were going on. There's always been a feeling that doctors, whether it's leeches 2,000 years ago or snake oil 100 years ago, they're providing sort of an answer to physical problems or that are going on with the individual. And what Hippocrates said is that the body will heal itself. The doctor's task is to help the body heal itself. So he was a big believer, like I am today, of more natural things. Why not exercise? Why not listen to more Dave Brubeck? Why not try to get a better sleep hygiene and stop having coffee at 4 o'clock in the afternoon? All those kinds of things would not be what many of your doctors are talking about, but steady exercise, eating right, trying to get a sense of peace and serenity via yoga or exercise, or would be more of the Hippocratic view of having the body heal thyself.
Well, you know, I mean, Roberta's been talking about that for years, and she talks about it as the symptoms that you have are a sign of your going progressively towards your own health. She even interprets them as a direction that you're going in, and don't interrupt that direction. But here we are. So a person, a doctor, or a person who becomes a doctor, a person who becomes a person who becomes a physician, he's got to do something. Right. I remember seeing a law. I remember this case many years ago. It was, I think, it was a RICO case, where the mafia was on trial, and they were on trial, and they were on, and there was this one mafia guy who wanted to defend himself, and the rest of them had highfalutin lawyers. And he wanted to defend himself, and he did a fabulous job. In fact, he won the trial for himself, and he won the trial for everybody else. Why were they so against him defending himself? Because they believed if we have lawyers, the lawyers have to be right. If we have doctors, the doctors have to do something. A physician must do something. I don't know if physicians could get managed care reimbursements for doing nothing. You know, by encourage person to not take medication. You think you get reimbursed on that?
Absolutely not, no. And when people go to a doctor, again, maybe there's, as you were talking about before, an infant, a childlike belief that daddy or mommy is going to fix them, where a lot of what we have to do as psychiatrists and doctors in general is help people fix thyself. They have to learn to do lifestyle changes and change the way they think and the way they're behaving that will get them towards health, not some fantasy that a pill or some procedure will magically make them feel better.
Kent Robert Shaw is on his way out the door. He has been with us. He's got a patient waiting, and he's darting out. He's going to change into his Superman clothing. There he goes. Gone. A wisp. He leaves a little shadow. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We are bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. What is this stuff he's talking about? He's saying, gotta be careful. You gotta be careful because you could do too much, and too often the physicians do too much. And that's why you want to learn as much as you can about yourself. And that's what we're doing here. WBAI is filled with people teaching you about yourself. And we're going to go. 212-209-2950. It's time for us to go and take care of the rest of us. We'll be back with you next Wednesday at 1 p.m., my friends. If you want to get in touch with me, you could go look at the website, thepositivemind.com, thepositivemind.com, one word, and you'll find Armand at brainlink.com.